Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it is all about compliance with the Constitution. And we are setting the record straight because you can't understand what compliance with the Constitution is unless you actually understand what those lines mean and how they were defined. And we're actually going through that with the ratification debates. You won't find any better source to actually provide those definitions to the clauses in the Constitution. There's a candidate running in Missouri. His name is Jerry Wistrand, and he is running for auditor. He has signed the pledge, and he's committed to full compliance of the Constitution. Therefore, I implore you to reach, you know, into your resources and figure out some way of supporting him financially, what have you. And so just check him out. I think it's Jerry for Missouri or something like that. Ballotpedia, you can look him up, and his site's there. And his contact information is on my candidate endorsement page on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. So with that, welcome back, Sean. And so, Sean, we were leaving off in our last episode going into the guns section where they were talking about raising armies and so forth. Well, Sean, we got any go-backs before we dive into the gun section here?
I don't believe so, sir. I think we're ready to move forward.
All right. The beauty of digital, the digital world, digital recording, and so forth. So go ahead and let's pick it up with Mr. Dawes talking about standing armies and guns. Thanks.
Observed upon the authority of Congress to raise and support armies that all the objections which had been made by gentlemen against standing armies were inapplicable to the present question, which was that as there must be an authority somewhere to raise and support armies, whether that authority ought to be in Congress. As Congress are the legislature upon the proposed plan of government, in them only, said he, should be lodged a power under debate. Some gentlemen seem to have confused ideas about standing armies. That the legislature of a country should not have power to raise armies is a doctrine he had never heard before. Charles II in England kept in pay an army of 5,000 men, and James II augmented them to 30,000. This occasioned a great and just alarm through the nation, and accordingly, when William III came to the throne, it was declared unconstitutional to raise or keep a standing army in time of peace without the consent of the legislature. Most of our own state constitutions have borrowed this language from the English Declaration of Rights, but none of them restrain their legislatures from raising and supporting armies. Those who never objected to such an authority in Congress, as vested by the old Confederation, surely ought not to object to such a power in Congress, whereas there is to be a new branch of representation arising immediately from the people, in which branch alone must originate those very grants that are to maintain an army. When we consider that this branch is to be elected every 2 years, there is great propriety in its being restrained from making any grants in support of the army for a longer space than that of their existence. If the election of this popular branch were for 7 years, as in England, the men who would make the first grant might also be the second and the third for the continuance of the army, and such an acquaintance might exist between the representatives in Congress and the leaders of the army as might be unfavorable to liberty. But the wisdom of the late convention has avoided this difficulty. The army must expire itself in 2 years after it shall be raised, unless renewed by representatives who, at that time, will have just come fresh from the body of the people. It will share the same fate as that of a temporary law, which dies at the time mentioned in the act itself, unless revived by some future legislature.
Okay, so interestingly enough, there's a couple things to get pulled out of this. So who is it that is really responsible for calling forth the army? It says Congress, right? But what did he say here?
He said body of the people, which would be the House of Representatives.
There you go. And he says specifically that the check on this is the fact that this body is reelected every 2 years, not every six or anything else. So, in other words, the argument for calling forth the army must come forth first out of the House, just like with taxation. In other words, any bill that is going to appropriate the spending and the taxation, it has to originate in from the House itself.
Right.
Okay. So, in other words, the House has these unique responsibilities that until you dive into it in the ratification debates, because I think when we went through this, I knew it was somewhere. I just couldn't find it. And here's one of the comments that covers it, that the House does have the primary responsibility of initiating the call. Now, he also was pointing out that the standing army was something that was maintained. To raise an army, because we kind of went through this, they have the authority to raise an army, but the appropriation can be no more than 2 years, tying it to the House. However, for them to raise the army, it requires that they must call forth the militia, and they only have three justifications to be able to form the army: execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So they don't have the power to call forth an army to send overseas. And so when we kind of look at these interconnecting dots, you can see that the standing army, for them to have a standing army, like they were doing with the cavalry, they got away with it. You know why? Because the cavalry was being used in the territory. As soon as they started maintaining a cavalry presence in the states that had been joined to the Union, that's where they started really violently, or I should say, unconstitutionally crossing the line in maintaining forces in states that should have actually had their own militia as the initial guard for their security. Now, because in looking at Article 4, Section 3, it states that Congress will have the power to make needful rules and regulations for the territories. And so if they're going to call forth an army, that's not deploying them out of the United States territories or outside the United States, but for security purposes such as invasions and insurrections by, you know, the heathens that are out there, whether that be the French, the English, or the Indians, or whomever's occupying in our territories. Because it's not like we went through and did a sweep, right? There was nobody could do that. They would constantly find people coming in from, you know, different nations. As a matter of fact, in New York, I think it was in the 1600s, they came across a Dutch settlement where they kind of took claim to this area of New York and called it New Amsterdam, which is one of the reasons why the state of New York was called New York, because that was the same thing as New Amsterdam. And so when they found them, and I don't know if you ever read the history. Did we cover this? Did we cover this on the show?
Not that I remember.
Oh, okay. So it was a pretty sizable settlement. There were a couple thousand people there. And this wasn't New York City proper. This was along the coastline. I forget where it was. But there was a discovery of this Dutch settlement. And the people that were the Dutch people that were there did not like the leader or the guy that was in charge of them. And when it came down time for either leave or we will fight you, or you would join to England, and you know, you would join this land to England, because we kind of already called this, because they were literally going to go into a turf war and maybe subdivide, possibly, if Holland wanted to go to war and try to protect their little footing, their toehold that they had, then they could have gone down that path. And I don't think that they wanted to, but I think they were just trying to get a small little colony in this little stretch of land. So there would have probably been a call for at least forces to get involved, but the people of the settlement did not like their leader, and they basically said, "We're not going to follow you. We're going to just adjoin to England and to, you know." And I, somehow they called New York, it used to be New Amsterdam, but then they called it New York. And that was, I guess, in fitting to the amount of people that were kind of there at that point in time in the early 1600s, when there was this mad rush to getting colonies or toeholds in the North American area because of it wasn't rich in gold, but it was rich in agricultural production. They saw this as the breadbasket of their future as they were running out of land because more and more people were taking up more land. I mean, if you look at the whole point of World War I, and then it even drove World War II, Germany was having problems feeding themselves. And so they needed land. And so they didn't think that the Belgians and the French would mind them taking their land. So anyway... land is a real, you know, one of the number one reasons for starting war. Probably the lowest reason for starting war is over a woman. I think the Helen of Troy. There may be, yep,
that launched 1,000 ships.
There you go. So there may have been maybe more than just the Helen of Troy that caused war. But there's always been reasons. But 9 times out of 10, it's, you know, they want or need that land. And they're willing to fight and go to town for it. So anyway, back to this. The king was maintaining standing armies. But the standing armies that they're talking about here were literally enforcing the laws of the king. And so the whole point of making sure that the militia couldn't be formed as a standing army for law enforcement. They could be called for the execution of the law. Once the law gets executed, then, and when I say executed, like the Whiskey Rebellion, there were places that were refusing to pay. They had a system of of receiving the money and taking and getting the money into the hands of the federal government via the sheriff and a marshal that would work with the different sheriffs of the area. And so for the most part, that's what they're, just like in England, the sheriffs and the marshals were working together in tax collection and elections themselves and so forth. And so, because crime wasn't really out of hand. And when we look at the Whiskey Rebellion, because they outright refused, then they had to call forth the militia, get the people to then, you know, finally follow the law, and then they could let the militia go. And if you look at how long the militia was in service, it wasn't that long. A month, maybe two at the most, and then they were relieved to go back home. So it's only for very short periods of time to do a very specific function. So the point is that they were complaining because the king had this brute squad that would literally go around and shake people down with his arbitrary laws until they got challenged to say, hey, you're violating our rights or what have you. But he still maintained that. And they pointed out Charles and James and so forth were doing that. And they wanted to make sure that they couldn't do that. And interestingly enough, they actually made it a law that they could not have a standing army. And that was specifically for that one very specific purpose. It had nothing to do with military. It had everything to do with law enforcement. So
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How did they have British troops in the colonies that were quartering themselves in people's houses and enforcing all these tyrannical acts by the king if they didn't have a standing military?
So who,
or
Britain?
A standing army.
Who, Britain?
No, yeah, Britain.
So they actually did have a standing army, but that standing army wasn't in Britain. So they were able to fund, and I think that they were talking about how long did it take for them to pay or go down this path of... because they had a 7 years or something like that. They mentioned a time frame that they could do it. But they just couldn't have a standing army, i.e. an army sitting in Britain for enforcement. Now, to be clear, they were pointing out that they took these measures. when Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were touring during the negotiations of the treaty with Britain at the end of the Revolutionary War, you'll find that the two of these men came across the cradle or the place where the Glorious Revolution was kicked off. And when they saw that, they kind of realized that things weren't the same as what the revolution was all about, such as the standing army and so forth. In other words, the English were pretty quick to give up their rights. And so they felt incumbent upon them to go down the path of chastising and kind of lecturing them so that they could say, hey, look, you know, you guys fought this revolution. This is the place where the Glorious Revolution was started. And look at where are your rights today? It's a kind of an interesting story. And there's a myth that basically made there's some people that made it out to be like they were just really harassing and giving the people a hard time. But they took point and got, you know, kind of, I don't want to say in anybody's grill, but the two of them, I mean, you don't want to insult a lot of people when it's just you two against them. So I think that they had a level of tact in trying to point out to the English people that, hey, you know, look at what the heck's going on here. And, you know, we just fought a revolution, you know, over these same principles, and you guys are just letting them walk all over you. That's what happens. And now look at them today. I mean, if you look at Britain today, it's just like they've never learned their lesson, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they never learned their lesson because they're too arrogant. And regardless of what the facade is, this is just my perspective, regardless of the facade that they put forth, there are groups of elite cabals that are running the government.
Sure.
And that's who facilitated all this migration to replace the native population.
Yeah, so we kind of covered this already when they talked about Parliament and who was in control of Britain. They already kind of identified the fact that the House of Lords was an aristocracy, and the House of Commons was controlled by that aristocracy.
Right.
So
they called it the House of Commons, but the House of Lords still was running it.
Yeah, they said the House of Commons had all the power, and they were the ones that, you know, because they owned all the property, and they were the ones that were supposed to print the money. And I mean, as we've gone through this, they've talked and called out how, you know, in Britain it was supposed to be this way and so forth. But in real facts, they were calling it out that the mob bosses or the borough bosses were really in control of the House of Commons, which was basically, you know, the thugs that were, you know, working for the aristocracy. When Britain was a caste system, and it has this, it's not transparent. I mean, it's not a black and white caste system like we had in America with slavery, or a dark and light caste system in India, but it seems like they... look at South Africa. They've gone into and have established caste systems or built off of caste systems, where you have a privileged class and a not so privileged class, and it's been that way. And the thing that's kind of forced Britain back onto the rails has been the slow integration of some of the even harder heads of the UK that they've had to bring in, such as the Scots, the Irish. Anyway, so, you know, as they tried to unify, they had to, you know, kind of make concessions and say, okay, we'll do better. And then over time, they would get back to their old antics. Anyway, let's go down.
Yeah, or they just, I'm sorry, or they just morph them into something different to fit the times, like the Fabians.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, the Fabians did come from Britain. Absolutely.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And that's the same thing they did after the Middle Ages when they started seeing all these populist movements. Instead of saying, oh, well, now it's time for a change, we don't need monarchy no more.
Right.
The monarchs just gave up their thrones and built mansions, and now they run corporations and NGOs and stuff, and they're still in charge. They're just behind the scenes, behind a facade of democratic government.
Right. As we look at what they're talking about here, I want to set the stage for this next one, because I'm not sure if we've mentioned this before, but and we've covered this on the show when we've gone through the ratification debates, but the exclusive legislation and this autonomy of the District of Columbia is really pretty well cased here, where they talk about the reason why there was to be no state government or separate government in control of the District of Columbia, or the seat of the national seat of government, where the general government of the federal government was going to sit and do its business. And they wanted to make sure they gave them enough land, so they figured, well, okay, because we didn't cover this in the notes on the Constitutional Convention, but if you really look at it, a 10 nautical mile square piece of land, that's a lot of land for a government to operate. I mean, you know, they had some, they must have had some pretty big plans. But nevertheless, this next section is going to dive into that. And this is where they provide, I think we've probably covered this already. You let me know if they haven't. But let's pick it up with Dr. Taylor. And this is going to be going from one to the next as they kind of do a little round robin in talking and complaining about this exclusive legislation in Article 1, Section 8, that they have supposedly this great power to be able to, you know, stir up all sorts of laws to inflict upon the Union. When they clarify that here, but they kind of help people understand why this seat needed to be created and separated, and that Congress would have full control over it. So go ahead, let's pick it up with Dr. Taylor. Thanks.
Dr. Taylor asked why there was not to be a federal town over which Congress is to exercise exclusive legislation. The Honorable Mr. Strong said, every gentleman must think that the erection of a federal town was necessary, wherein Congress might remain protected from insult. A few years ago, said the Honorable Gentleman, Congress had to remove because they were not protected by the authority of the state in which they were then sitting. He asked whether this convention, though convened for but a short period, did not think it was necessary that they should have power to protect themselves from insult. Much more so must they think it necessary to provide for Congress, considering there are to be a permanent body. The Honorable Mr. Davis of Boston said it was necessary that Congress should have a permanent residence, and that it was the intention of Congress under the Confederation to erect a federal town. He asked, would Massachusetts or any other state wish to give to New York or the state in which Congress shall sit the power to influence the proceedings of that body, which was to act for the benefit of the whole, by leaving them liable to the outrage of the citizens of such states? Dr. Taylor asked why it need be 10 miles square and whether 1 mile square would not be sufficient. Honorable Mr. Strong said Congress was not to exercise jurisdiction over a district of 10 miles, but one not exceeding 10 miles square. Reverend Mr. Stillman said that whatever were the limits of the district, it would depend on the session of the legislature of one of the states.
Okay, so right there, let's take a quick break because we just ran out of time. But to kind of set this up, so Mr. Taylor kept on asking these questions. Well, why a federal town? Why 10 miles square? And so they were kind of laying down and answering very specifically why. And so we'll come back to how they wrap this up right after this short break. So folks, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we kind of, in doing this little, you know, asking a quick question and a couple respond, another question, so forth, they're covering a few key things that have completely been lost. Completely been lost since the founding, where people really think that, you know, the Constitution really did create a democracy and this large national government and so forth. Because these basic questions that he's asking have been, and how they've refuted or basically clarified, no, that's not the case. This is why, this is why, this is why. That is not the standard paradigm today. Like, people look at the Constitution, we the people, you know, we foreordained the Constitution, that we, you know, we did it, when actually it was the states. It was the 13 sovereignties, the people of the 13 sovereign states. And Madison kind of points this out. So these types of things have been completely lost by our national indoctrination system, as well as by those who are manipulating us. But the other thing that I realize, Mr. Stillman, every once in a while it's Honorable Stillman or Honorable Mr. Stillman, Reverend Mr. Stillman. So the title's kind of changed, but there are quite a few reverends involved in the debates up here. And I know I've told you this, but let's go ahead and let's repeat what Mr. Stillman said, because the music kind of kicked in at that point, and then we'll take it down further in the dialogue or the little round robin. Thanks.
Reverend Mr. Stillman said that whatever were the limits of the district, it would depend on the session of the legislature of one of the states. Mr. Dinch said that he wished further light on the subject, but from the words, we the people, in the first clause ordaining this constitution, he thought it was an actual consolidation of the states, and that, if he was not mistaken, the moment it took place, a dissolution of the state governments will also take place. General Brooks of Lincoln rose. He said, to consider the idea suggested by the gentleman last speaking that this Constitution would produce a dissolution of the state's governments or a consolidation of the whole, which in his opinion, he said, was ill-founded, or rather a loose idea. In the first place, says he, the Congress under its Constitution cannot be organized without repeated acts of the legislatures of the several states, and therefore, if the creating power is dissolved, the body to be created cannot exist. In the second place, says the general, it is impossible the general government can exist unless the governments of the several states are forever existing, as the qualifications of the electors of the federal representatives are to be the same as those of the electors of the most numerous branch of the legislatures. It was therefore, he said, impossible that the state's government should be annihilated by the general government, and it was, he said, strongly implied from that part of the section under debate which gave Congress power to exercise exclusive jurisdiction over the federal town, that they shall have it over no other place. When we attend to the Constitution, we shall see, says the general, that the powers to be given to Congress amount only to a consolidation of the strength of the Union, and that private rights are not considered consolidated. The general mentioned the rights which Congress could not infringe upon, and said that their power to define what was treason was much less than is vested in the legislature of this state by our own Constitution, as it was confined in the third section of Article 3rd to levying war or adhering to and comforting enemies only. He mentioned the restraint upon Congress and the punishment of treason, and compared it with the extended powers lodged in the Parliament of Great Britain on like crimes, and concluded by observing that as the United States guaranteed to each state a republican form of government, the state governments were as effectually secured as though this Constitution should never be enforced.
Okay. Keep going.
Honorable Mr. King said, in reply to the inquiry respecting a federal town, that there was now no place for Congress to reside in, and that it was necessary that they should have a permanent residence where to establish proper archives in which they may deposit treaties, state papers, deeds of cession, etc. The Honorable Mr. Singletary said that all gentlemen had said about a Bill of Rights to the Constitution was that what is written, but he thought we were giving up all power and that the states will be like towns in this state. Towns, said he, have a right to lay taxes, to raise money, and the states possibly may have the same. We have now, said he, a good Republican Constitution, and we do not want it guaranteed to us. He did not understand what gentlemen meant by Congress guaranteeing a republic form of government. He wished they would not play round the subject with their fine stories, like a fox round a trap, but to come to it. Why don't they say that Congress will guarantee our state constitution?
So, I don't know if it comes up here, but I do know it comes up in other debates where they mention and talk about the differences, the disparities between the different governments. And so they wanted to make sure that they lowered the bar to allow the states to function in any way they wanted to, as long as they were Republican in form. And I've covered this before, that when you look at, you know, the states and how their government was configured, only three of the 13 states had independent jury or justices or courts. Three states had independent courts. The rest of the states, well, actually one state didn't even have a court system. That was Rhode Island. And all of the other nine states, the courts were subordinate to the legislature. So when he's talking about, you know, guaranteeing a constitution or something very specific, the convention in Philadelphia realized that they couldn't get specific, because then they would be stepping on this state's toes or that state's toes. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
So,
but at the same time, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but
no, the
question just came to my mind. How are they going to meet the requirements in the Constitution for the electors, for the representatives and the senators and stuff, if they don't have a Republican form of government?
Well, so, yeah, that actually means more Republican than Democratic. In other words, they made sure that the president would not be a popular, we would not have a populist president, where the name of the president was on the ballot and people voted directly for that. That they had to vote for a person that they would trust in selecting who their president would be. That's the whole point of the Electoral College. That has been completely perverted by the party system and the primaries. Because the parties today, folks, you tell me who you voted for out of the past three presidential elections. Who did you vote for as your elector that cast the ballot in your, you know, for president in, what, 2012, 2018, or 2016, 2020, and coming up in 2024? That's past four. So if you go back four elections, back to Obama, his midterm, back to Clinton and Trump, then Biden and Trump, that's three, I'm sorry. But if you go back to those three, then, and then actually it was Harris and Trump, so there was four. If you go back, you should have voted for a different elector. Or did you vote for the same elector? Because the electors are the ones that we're supposed to elect. They're the ones that actually, that's why if you read the 12th Amendment, we get to it, you know, in Constitution Month or whatever, when we get to the Constitution Day, we'll start reading the Constitution. We're going to read that. And you're going to see that the people that actually write the names down on a ballot, that who's going to be president specifically and who's going to be vice president specifically, are the electors of the Electoral College. And they got one whack at it, basically. They got, I think, a second retry, something like that. If not, then it goes to Congress. And then Congress, the House of Representatives, will choose the president. And the Senate will choose the vice president. So this is, you know, these are checks and balances in protecting us from a mob rule government that very few people really appreciate. But there's so many people out there, when they hear me say we've got to get rid of the primaries and we got to get rid of, you know, the party choosing the electors, they don't hear what I'm saying because they think I'm, you know, I want to get rid of the Electoral College. No, I want to restore the Electoral College. I want to see we the people voting for our electors again, because that's how it was up until 1856. Anyway, anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. So now we jump down to Saturday, January 26th. And let me see. They jump right into, actually, no, this is a highlight on the ninth section. This is where they talk about the slave compromise. So this is kind of a high-level capture report on kind of what happened that I've wanted to make an administrative note of. So let's go ahead and read that one little comment there.
The debate on the ninth section still continued desultory and consisted of similar objections and answers thereto as had before been used. Both sides deprecated slave trade in the most pointed terms. On one side, it was most pathetically lamented by Mr. Mason, Major Lusk, Mr. Neal, and others that this Constitution provided for the continuation of the slave trade for 20 years. And on the other, the Honorable Judge Dana, Mr. Adams, and others rejoiced that a door is now to be opened for the annihilation of this odious, abhorrent practice in a certain time.
Ah, now that Mr. Adams is Samuel Adams, by the way, not John. okay, so let's go down, and on January 30th, they start diving into these topics and common law. So let's start off with common law, then they get into new states and slavery. Go ahead.
So why do you think they just made this little comment instead of including the verbatim of the debate?
I think it was just because it was so more passionate than anything else. You know, they get to a point where, just like with New York, they actually made an administrative note that there was a scuffle. I mean, words went to blows. It seemed like it went to a point where they just felt embarrassed to probably document the entire, you know, brouhaha. So they just wanted to make an administrative note and kind of highlight the leaders of the two sides. The whole point was all of Massachusetts was against the slave trade. One wanted to just see it exterminated. They weren't happy that there was any concession at all. And the other side said, at least we have the door to closing it in this Constitution, where that wasn't in the Articles of Confederation. So you want to reject it? Because it's, you know, we're not getting rid of it, so we can go back to the Articles of Federation where there's no door to closing it. That was, I think. Then this just went on, and so anyway, I don't know. For whatever purposes, they've kind of followed their guidelines. As a matter of fact, if you actually take the time, folks, when you read these things, you'll find that sometimes they actually document the rules, you know, of how they're going to conduct the convention. You know, what the scribes, and as a matter of fact, at the end of each day, those people who spoke would, you know, circle around. If they wanted to, they could circle around and go talk to the scribes and find out what they wrote to make sure they captured what they said. And at the very end of the convention, they kind of went through all of the notes and compiling them just to make sure that that process was being done right, too. So when they did this stuff back then, they didn't have the advent of computers and, you know, transcribing with a little bit of AI, what have you, like we have today. You know, videos and great ways of archiving and capturing the passion, everything, right? So the fact that they understood the importance and the fact that they actually documented it to the degree that they did, what a godsend.
Oh, absolutely. I was just wondering if maybe there was some reason behind them not extrapolating that debate, like they didn't want to raise the ire of some people or bring it to the forefront or kind of keep it tucked off to the side or, you know, you don't talk about abortion in certain audiences or whatever because it's just such a polarizing topic that some people can't discuss it.
Yeah, so and I think that they did discuss it. We just didn't cover it because if you actually look at that commentary and slaves, and if you actually go, you'll notice that we didn't read anything that was stated on Friday the 25th. That was all about slavery and such. And I just made the note to say, hey, it looks like on Saturday they go down the same path of repeating that stuff, and then they add these extra commentaries from Ames and so forth. They do carry some commentaries, but they're just making this note that, hey, we kind of stuck in this rut, or, you know, making the same arguments back and forth over, you know, a matter that, you know, it's not going to resolve anything other than they've already stated their side. Are they ready to take it to a vote to determine whether they're going to reject the Constitution on this one issue and this and the way this, the sides have dug in? Because there's just so many other things to do. They still have to cover the rest of the Constitution. And so, I don't know. I mean, I just use this when I get that note to kind of give everybody a view that, wow, they spent a whole day plus. And actually, they get back into it because there's another comment coming right after this one with common law. New states and slavery is the following up with this one. So, anyway.
Okay, we ready to move on?
Yep, common law. Yep, common law.
Mr. Dawes said he did not see that the right of trial by jury was taken away by the article. The word court does not, either by a popular or technical construction, exclude the use of a jury to try facts. When people in common language talk of a trial at the Court of Common Pleas or the Supreme Judicial Court, do they not include all the branches and members of such court, the jurors as well as the judges? They certainly do, whether they mention the jurors expressly or not. Our state legislators have construed the word court in the same way, for they have given appeals from a justice of peace to the Court of Common Pleas and from thence to the Supreme Court without saying anything of the jury. But in cases which almost time out of mind have been tried without jury, there the jurisdiction is given expressly to the justices of a particular court, as may be instanced by suits upon the Absconding Act, so called.
Okay, so that next line is just a little insert that I put in there. Mm-hmm. That's just a note.
Why common law was not centered by the federal government.
Right.
Gentlemen,
go ahead.
Have compared the article under consideration to that power which the British claimed and we resisted at the Revolution, namely, the power of trying the Americans without a jury. But surely there was no parallel in this case. It was criminal cases in which they attempted to make this abuse of power. Mr. D mentioned one example of this, which, though young, he well remembered, and that was the case of Nickerson, the pirate, who was tried without a jury, and whose judges were the governors of Massachusetts and of some neighboring provinces, together with Admiral Montague and some gentlemen of distinction. Although this trial was without a jury, yet, as it was a trial upon the civil law, There's not so much clamor about it as otherwise there might have been, but still it was disagreeable to the people and was one of the then complaints. But the trial by jury was not attempted to be taken from civil causes. It was no object of power whether one subject property was lessened while another's was increased, nor can it be now an object with the federal legislature. What interest can they have in constituting a judiciary to proceed in civil causes without a trial by jury? In criminal causes, by the proposed government, there must be a jury. It is asked, why is not the Constitution as explicit in securing the right of jury in civil as in criminal cases? The answer is, because it was out of the power of the convention. The several states differ so widely in their modes of trial, some states using a jury in causes wherein other states employ only their judges, that the convention had very wisely left it to the federal legislature to make such regulation as shall as far as possible accommodate the whole. Thus our own state constitution authorizes the general court to erect judicatories, but leaves the nature, number, and extent of them wholly to the discretion of the legislature. The Bill of Rights indeed secures the trial by jury in civil causes, except in cases where a contrary practice has obtained. Such a clause as this some gentlemen wish were inserted in the proposed Constitution. But such a clause would be abused in that the Constitution, as has been clearly stated by the honorable gentleman from Charlestown, Mr. Gorham, because the exception of all cases where a jury have not heretofore been used would include almost all cases that could be mentioned when applied to all the states, for they have severally differed in the kinds of causes where they have tried without a jury.
He basically repeats kind of what was stated in the convention very clearly. He says, look, the states couldn't allow that because of the way they were so disparate in the application of common law and just this one thing under common law, the trial by jury. So in other words, the federal government cannot meddle with the justice system of a state. And yet today, they've manhandled us and they've literally taken away our common law and our own self-destiny and own control over our own justice systems. Are we better for it? Well, it doesn't matter. They don't have the authority. Okay, so now he dives into, dives into new states and slavery.
I think that's a really great point that you just made. It doesn't matter. The point is moot of whether it's better or worse, or they don't have that authority.
Right.
Period.
Right.
So it doesn't matter. New states and slavery. Mr. General Heath, Mr. President, by my indisposition and absence, I have lost several important opportunities. I've lost the opportunity of expressing my sentiments with a candid freedom on some of the paragraphs of the system, which have lain heavy on my mind. I have lost the opportunity of expressing my warm approbation on some of the paragraphs. I have lost the opportunity of asking some questions for my own information touching some of the paragraphs, and which naturally occurred as the system unfolded. I have lost the opportunity of hearing those judicious, enlightening, and convincing arguments which have been advanced during the investigation of the system. This is my misfortune, and I must bear it. The paragraph respecting the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, etc., is one of those considered during my absence, and I have heard nothing on the subject save what has been mentioned in this morning. But I think the gentlemen who have spoken have carried the matter rather too far on both sides. I apprehend that it is not our power to do anything for or against those who are in slavery in the southern states. No gentleman within these walls detests every idea of slavery more than I do. It is generally detested by the people of this commonwealth, and I ardently hope that the time will soon come when our brethren in southern states will view it as we do and put a stop to it. But to this we have no right to compel them. Two questions naturally arise. If we ratify the Constitution, shall we do anything by our act to hold the blacks in slavery, or shall we become the partakers of other men's sins? I think neither of them. Each state is sovereign and independent to a certain degree, and the states have a right, and they will regulate their own internal affairs as to themselves appears proper. And shall we refuse to eat or to drink or to be united with those who do not think or act just as we do? Surely not. We are not, in this case, partakers of other men's sins, for nothing we do voluntarily encourages the slavery of our fellow men. A restriction is laid on the federal government which could not be avoided, and a union take place. The federal convention went as far as they could. The migration and importation, etc., is confined to the states now existing only. New states cannot claim it. Congress, by their ordinance for erecting new states sometime since, declared that the new states shall be Republican and that there shall be no slavery. There shall be no slavery in them. But whether those in slavery in the southern states would be emancipated after the year 1808, I do not pretend to determine. I rather doubt it.
So you see something that was said here that actually shines light in a completely new way on new states coming into the Union. And I don't think he was accurate, but it's still a definition as a proponent for the Constitution. He's claiming that Congress, by their ordinance for erecting new states sometime since, declared that new states shall be Republican and that there shall be no slavery in them.
Yeah, I caught that too. And okay. That's not what happened, is it?
No, it's really... So the reality is what he said is correct. You can't have your bread buttered on all six sides, right? There's six sides to a cube or whatever, a loaf. And so you can butter one side because you can determine what you want. You can't determine, inflict, and compel, and all these other types of things. So the states are sovereign, and the states, if they wanted to have slavery, it would be upon them to be able to do that. It's just that they will not be able to utilize the importation of slaves after the year of 1808. And again, this really goes back to, you have to look at the Constitution and this compromise at a very macro view, that what really ended up happening, new states did join the Union, and those new states such as Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana had slavery. And as Missouri was getting ready, and Kentucky and Tennessee had slavery. So as they started joining the Union, they started realizing that Missouri wasn't going to have slavery. And this is the whole reason why there was a lot of buzzing and talking from post the War of 1812 going into 1820 to get everybody postured and prepared and in office to provide. There's no doubt in my mind, they waited on Missouri coming forth to joining the Union until they had the ability to force slavery upon it by giving Congress the power to inflict slavery, which goes right in direct conflict with what he was just saying right here, that they couldn't have slavery. So not that he was necessarily wrong, but it's a self-determination point. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.